Good evening. I'm Larry Seams, Director of Freedom to Write and International Programs at Penn American Center. As many of you know, Penn was founded just after the First World War on the principle that discussions among writers from different countries and cultures can reduce the kinds of tensions that lead to such catastrophic conflicts. That we are all here tonight is largely because of our commitment to that principle, a commitment we share with the American Association of University Professors and the American Academy of Religion, our co-plaintiffs in the lawsuits challenging the exclusion of Tariq Ramadan from the United States, and of course with the ACLU, which so brilliantly argued our case. On behalf of the AAUP and the American Academy of Religion and all the members of Penn American Center, I want to thank Jamil Jaffer, Melissa Goodman, and everyone else at the ACLU who defended our right as Americans to hear a full range of voices and ideas and our ability as Penn to carry out our work. Next month, Larry McMurtry, who was then the president of Penn American Center, testified before Congress about the dangers of excluding those whose views our government disfavors from the United States. Emphasizing the importance Penn assigns to discussions such as the one we will have this evening, McMurtry said, "Because we are writers, we know that reading one another's work is vital, but we also know that meeting one another face-to-face in free discussion and debate is vital too. As readers of foreign books, we respond strongly to the truths inherent in all serious literature. We try hard to remain sensitive to the social and cultural subtleties that are apt to be lost in translation. But when we meet, the dialogue that ensues both expands and clarifies the perceptions and experiences we have in common. With hope and goodwill, we begin to forge common perspectives. Such nourishing exchanges might have once been deemed the luxuries of intellect, cultural feasts, if you will. Today, in a world of truly international dependencies, these meetings are more than luxuries. They are moral imperatives." At the time, McMurtry was talking about the effects of the McCarran-Walter Act, which kept many of the world's leading writers out of the United States because of their allegedly communist or socialist views. Our lawsuit challenging the ban on Professor Ramadan was a response to a new wave of exclusions after 9/11, in which scores of prominent international writers and activists had their visas canceled and were barred from entering the U.S. We are extremely grateful to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton for reviewing Professor Ramadan's case and making it possible for all of us to be here this evening. We will be working with the AAUP, the ACLU, and the administration to make sure other post-9/11 exclusions are also reviewed and reversed. I do feel a little bit freer this evening. Tonight's topic is timely and serious, but this event is also a celebration. I'm going to turn this over to Jamil now, but before I do, I have to thank Cooper Union and our co-sponsors, the ACLU and the American Association of University Professors and Slate for making tonight's program possible. Thanks to Jacob Weisberg and our outstanding panelists, and many, many thanks to all of you for your patience and for joining us this evening. Jamil.
Thanks, Larry, and thanks to all of you for joining us this evening. I'm Jamil Jaffer. I'm the director of the ACLU's National Security Project. That Tariq Ramadan is in the United States at all is a testament to the advocacy and commitment of three different organizations: the American Academy of Religion, the American Association of University Professors, and Penn American Center. 6 years ago, the Bush administration revoked Professor Ramadan's visa and effectively banned him from the United States. With the help of the ACLU, the three organizations I mentioned brought a lawsuit under the First Amendment to challenge the ban. An appeals court eventually rejected the Bush administration's basis for the ban, and as Larry said, earlier this year, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton signed an order that lifted the ban altogether. If not for the lawsuit that three American organizations filed several years ago, this evening's discussion wouldn't be taking place at all. At the end of this evening, we can all decide for ourselves whether what Tariq Ramadan has to say is persuasive or unsettling or even infuriating. But we should take a moment to appreciate that we can decide for ourselves. One point of the First Amendment is to create a political space in which we can discuss and debate issues of public concern without government interference or censorship. Tonight's discussion takes place within that protected political space. In many other countries, that space doesn't exist at all. It's the government that decides which ideas get heard. It's the government that decides which ideas are worthwhile and which ones aren't. We have the opportunity, and in fact, we have the constitutionally protected right to decide for ourselves. And we have this right because organizations like AAR, AAUP, and Pan American Center protect and defend that right. On behalf of the ACLU, I'd like to thank those three organizations, as well as the Cooper Union, Slate Magazine, and all of the panelists. And it's now my pleasure to introduce Jacob Weisberg, chairman of the Slate Group.
I want to thank Jaleel for the introduction. I want to welcome everyone here tonight. And I want to thank Penn and the ACLU and the American Association of University Professors for doing the work that made tonight's event possible, both over the past several years in pressing the suit to allow Professor Ramadan to enter the country and in organizing the event tonight. I'm going to very quickly introduce our panelists so we can get down to it, and then I will explain a few things about the format, and we'll start right in. To begin, at the far end, George Packer is a writer for The New Yorker. He's the author of several books, including his most recent collection, Interesting Times. Dahlia Moghahed works for the Gallup Organization. She's the co-author of a book entitled Who Speaks for Islam? Professor Ramadan needs no introduction. I think you all know who he is. Joan Wallach Scott is a sociologist, and historian. I was getting to that. She's at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. She's also the author of the book The Politics of the Veil, and she is former chairman of the Academic Freedom Committee of the American Association of University Professors. Now, as I think you all know, this is Professor Ramadan's first appearance in front of a United States audience before he was denied a visa by the Bush administration, which, as Jaleel and Larry were saying, denied all of us a chance to hear from him directly for a period of years. So the focus tonight is going to be on him and his views. And here's the format we've all agreed to for tonight's discussion. Professor Ramadan is going to give some opening remarks for about 10 minutes. Then I'm going to give each of our panelists 5 to 10 minutes to respond to his remarks, ask him questions. We may ask each other some questions. Then I'm going to take around 10 minutes to ask him some questions myself. We're going to save a half an hour at the end for questions from all of you in the audience. And here's how we're going to do it. David asked if you had pens and paper. The reason for that is we want you to write your questions down, and we want you to pass them to the aisle. And the time to pass them to the aisle and give them to the people who will be collecting them is when George Packer, who's going to go last, finishes his 10 minutes, and when I'm starting my 10 minutes. So the questions will all be collected. They'll be brought up here. I'll remind you. Don't worry if that's too confusing. But the point is you have some time, but in about 55 minutes into the event, we're going to collect all the questions. They'll be brought up to me, and I will read them. And I will not select them on the basis of what the questions are. I will merely select them on the basis of which are the pithiest and most legible. So let that be a challenge to all of you. I want to say I know this is going to be an excellent audience. I can tell already. But let me remind you to turn off your cell phones. I want to appeal to everyone to listen respectfully tonight. That means please hold your applause, if you possibly can, until the end of the event. This event is made possible by organizations that are advocates, are leading advocates for freedom of expression, and I'd like us to be a very good example of that principle tonight. And with that, I give you Professor Tariq Ramadan.
Thank you so much for being here this evening, and I want to start. I just arrived yesterday. This is the first time I'm talking after 6 years of being banned from this country. So let me start by thanking first the four organizations that were supporting me for during this 6 years, and especially, of course, with ACLU, as Jamil and Melissa. They did a very great job, and I want to thank them. With AAR, of course, PEN and AAUP, from the very beginning, these organizations were supporting me, and they were in touch with me, saying that what is happening in this country is wrong, in the light of the American values and our common values and our common dignity. So this is something which is, for me, quite important to thank them, but also to thank all the people who were in touch with me from the States and inviting me for video lecture, conference, saying, we are not going to accept that. This is wrong, and this is not the way forward. I want to thank them, and I want to thank all the people also who are here and not here, but also these people who did not agree with me, who have read and say, no, we don't agree, but still said the decision of the American, the Bush administration was wrong. I want to thank them because for me, for now and for the future, these are the people showing the dignity of the country. We disagree, but you should come. You should be able to speak, and you should be able to say what you have to say. So thank you for this support, and thank you for being here. In the room here this evening, there are also people that I want just to mention. So many, but I don't have time. But there is with me Mona Ali, who is my assistant here, without whom it would have been impossible for me to do the work I have been doing. So thank you for your support from the very beginning. And our journey started 10 years ago when I came here in the States. Cynthia Reed, she's here, and she's my publisher. And once again, for your trust and your company during this last years, thank you so much for being here, you and your husband. And I just heard that one of my friends also who was supportive from the very beginning, Benjamin Barber, is here. So once again, thank you. And I have so many other people to thank, but let me come to the point of our discussion here this evening. It's mainly what we are talking about. It's mainly about secularism, Islam, and democracy, and it's our situation in the West. A few years ago, when I started to think about our presence in Europe and in the West, I stopped speaking about Muslims in Europe and Muslims in the West by saying we are European Muslims, we are Western Muslims, and it's completely different. The difference is that we are not here in a host country. We are at home, and Islam is a Western religion. Why? Because we have citizens in Europe, citizens in the States, citizens in Canada. They are citizens, they live as citizens, they abide by the law, and they are making it the reality of our time. So this is the starting point of a mindset that we have to change. And I got reactions coming from Muslims saying, no, 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 you have to speak about Muslims in Europe. I say, no. I'm European by culture, Swiss by nationality, and Muslim by religion, and all this is fine. There is no contradiction. So the point for me, the starting point of our discussion is this, and not only to rely on perceptions, because very often, just after September 11th in this country, you had President Bush speaking about the Muslims in a way which was us versus them. They don't like our values. He was speaking about the extremists, but implicitly, the message that we got is there is a problem with Muslims. And still, what we have now in our European countries, as well as here, is still when we speak about Muslims, is as if we don't speak about true Americans, true Europeans. There are still the other with it, the outsider with it. So I would say that this is the starting point of our discussion. So how can we change the mindset? Is to go from perceptions to facts and figures. And what we have now is millions of Western Muslims are getting the three L's that I'm mentioning in the last book, What I Believe. The first one is that they abide by the law. So they don't have a problem with the secular system. if we understand the secular system. The secular system is not against religion, is to make it clear that we are distinguishing power and authorities, that the state, the power of the state, is something which has nothing to do with the power of the authority of religion. The private sphere is where we decide for ourselves, so we don't have a problem with this as Muslim citizens. We abide by the law, and this is the first L. The second L, which is everywhere now in all the European and the Western countries, and this is the case here in the States, is that we speak the language of the country, and there is no problem with this. So look at what is happening with the second, third, and onward generations now. They are American, they are European, and they speak English, German, French, as all the others. They are citizens of their country, abiding by the law, speaking the language. And then there is something which is quite important, and this is the starting point also of our discussion. This is where I got the problem, which pushed an administration to ban me from the country, is that we are loyal to our country and loyal to our values. What does it mean to be loyal? It means that I'm loyal to my country when I'm a committed citizen. And when I'm a committed citizen means that when I agree with my government, I'm going to support it. But when I disagree in the name of my free citizenship, in the name of my freedom of speech, I should be able to say that's wrong. I should be able, for example, to say that to go to Iraq is wrong. I should be able, for example, to be involved in anything which has to do with social injustices or anything which has to do with discrimination, racism, unemployment, and international issues. This is the only way to be loyal as a citizen, is to be critically, constructively loyal. And the great majority, and it's huge. If you speak with all the governments around the, Europe and in the West, they will say, we don't have a problem with the great majority of the Muslim citizens. So they abide by the law, they are loyal, and they speak the language. So this is something which is quite important for us. And this is why I'm speaking about the post-integration process, saying now it's time not to speak about integrating or being integrated, it's to speak about contribution. What do you give to your country, in which way you are providing something, which is the step forward, which is you, when you give something, the people are not asking where do you come from. They want to know where we are going together. So this is what is happening now. And look at what is happening with the citizens in America, in Canada, and in Europe. If you look at facts and figures and what they are saying, they feel that they are Europeans. The perception is, oh, they want Musk not to integrate. It's exactly the opposite. They want Musk, they want organization, they want institutions, in fact, to be really Europeans, really Americans and Canadians. So the point is that if we rely on facts and figures and we listen to the people, they feel at home, and more young generation, you know, young Muslims and new generations are showing or paving the way towards this reality of contributing. And not only this is a reality, but if you also look at facts and figures, you will see that the driving force is very often women, Muslim women, who are paving the road, who are involved in the process through education, through their critical thinking and their presence. Saying exactly the opposite of when you look at the way they dress, you may think that they are oppressed. But if you listen to what they think and the way they are involved in the Muslim communities now, you are just getting a sense that there is a new leadership, that there is empowerment here, and we have to respect this. And this is what I have been promoting for the last 20 years. Let me add something which is quite important for all of us. That if you ask someone, what are you first an American or are you first a Muslim? Let me start by saying it's a silly question. I don't want to answer silly questions. I have multiple identities. If you ask me about me when I'm going to vote, I'm a Swiss. If you ask me who I am when I'm dealing with my own death, I'm a Muslim, because this is where I'm putting the meaning of my life. If you are asking me what is my origin, I'm an Egyptian by origin. So I have multiple identities. And mind you, don't reduce yourself to a specific exclusive identity. You know what it means? That you are becoming a poor mind if you only think through an exclusive identity. We all have multiple identities, and the priority could change depending on the environment and what we are doing. So this is why when we get that sense, we need to have a sense of, you know, a kind of confidence in our identities, but at the same time, humility. Humility means that we should hear and we can learn from people around us.
that we can take from others. So as a Western Muslim, I can take, and I am taking from the surrounding society. The fact that I was born and raised in Europe is something which is quite important. I took a lot from the European culture. I'm European by culture. And it's not a problem to be a Muslim and a European by culture. And it's not a problem to be an American by culture and a Muslim by religion. It's not a problem. And I'm adding and adding, and with humility, I'm taking from the people around me. But to take means to listen to. It's to have this positive attitude, which is people around me coming from different backgrounds and coming from different religions can add. And this is a very important question for the American society. It's a very important question for all the Western societies. Do you think that your Muslim citizens could add something, contribute something? Can you learn from them? I ask you the question. Not in the past by saying, oh, it was a great civilization. It was. Who you are now is something else. But you were good. You are great. And some Muslims are playing exactly the same game by speaking about the past. I think it's quite important here to speak about this multiple identity. Humility is important, respect is important, and a sense of consistency. The most important danger, the deeper danger that we are facing, the threat for our societies, this is what I'm saying in Europe, and this is what I'm saying to America, is not the Muslim presence. It's because we are scared of this Muslim presence is to betray our own principles. Is to be able to discriminate, is to be able to legally discriminate by saying, oh, they want to colonize our countries. They are not ready to be Americans or Europeans, they are colonizing. So we come with a very restrictive understanding of our common law. The secular system was to integrate diversity, not to exclude. It's not us versus them, it's us together in the name of the common law. So let us be consistent, humble in the way we look at things, and also full of respect. So with this, and let me just conclude with this is the vision for me for the future, is to be able to say, let us look at facts and figures, the dimension of contribution, and also these multiple identities based on a very deep understanding of what humility means, respect, and consistency. But still, we should not be naive. There are challenges ahead. And the first one for all the Muslims, and I have been saying this, and this is why I'm also having some problems within the Muslim communities, is that we have to come back to our texts. We have to come back to our sources and to come with a critical thinking by saying what we are repeating for decades may be wrong. We may have to reassess our understanding in the light of the new environment. And we should do this in the West as well as in Muslim majority countries. This is why in the book Radical Reform, I'm crossing the board. I'm saying these are challenges for all the Muslims living in the contemporary world, not only for Western Muslims. But for Muslims living in the West, they have the opportunities and they have the space to be able to promote the thinking and also to be connected to Muslim majority countries. So there is no way to cut ourselves from the Muslim majority countries and the Muslims living there. It's an ongoing dialogue, but it's a challenge on women, on the understanding secularism, on understanding the very meaning of separation of authority and not connecting this to the past, to colonization, to something which is against religion. It was not, it should not be, and these are challenges. The second thing which is really important for us here, and I am advocating a new we, and the new we is look at this room. Muslims, non-Muslims, atheists, Jews, Christians, we are all together. We have a common future. So the point is for all of us to say, okay, how are we going to build this sense of belonging to the common future? It's also to be able to learn about the people who are living. And there is a lack of knowledge. Not only a lack of knowledge of Islam, I'm sorry, a lack of knowledge for Christians about Christianity, for Jews about Judaism, for secular people about secularity. There is a lack of knowledge about memory. Because we are scared of the present, we are reducing the past. You can listen to things that are said about Europe. For example, the past of Europe is as if Islam was not there. So you have to say, you know what? We may need a dialogue with ourselves instead of speaking about the dialogue with others. So knowledge is important, and this is where it's quite important to come back to memory, philosophy, history. This is what we also have to teach. Let me just add two things and end with this. All of us, we should be very cautious to not to accept this confusion in our current discussion. When we speak about religion and when we speak about the Islam, we should come to this religious discussion, but not to confuse this with socioeconomic problems. What we need with people being discriminated, with violence in the suburbs, for example, in France, in the inner cities now, when you listen to African-American telling you you have a problem with racism, but you have a problem with equal citizenship. Now, not talking about religion. It's not a religious problem. It's a socio-economic problem needing social policies. We need policies on this. We don't need to speak about, you know, identity, integration, culture. This is not the point. The point is, are you serious? Are you consistent with democracy, with democratic values, that is equal citizenship for all of us, if you are rich and if you are poor, if you are black and if you are white? I'm saying this to the United States of America because you know the problem that you have with this, but not only to the Americans. I'm saying this also to all the Muslims around the world, because they may say Islam is not promoting racism, but Muslims are very often promoting racist attitudes towards the black, towards some of the people who are poor people. I think that this is something that we have to challenge. And the last point for me is really also to be able to understand that we should connect this to international issues. We should be critical. You know, I know why I was banned from this country. That has nothing to do with my terrorist views or my view about violence. I was invited by the State Department 5 months before being banned from this country. And I said it. I am condemning violent extremism, and I have nothing to do with this. But I'm not going to keep quiet when I think that the American policy is wrong, when going to Iraq was wrong and was illegal, that not to support the right of Palestinians, in my view, is wrong, and I want something which is a more balanced policy coming from the United States of America. I'm still waiting for this, but I think that this is my right. This is where I am a true citizen. This is the dignity when I am asked, I'm free to speak about this. You know, yesterday when I arrived, I entered, and it was good. After 1 hour, it was good. This is the first step. But between my entrance and just before coming outside, I was asked, what are you going to speak about? What are the topics? I said, that's fine. The first step is to enter. The second step, no questions, please. No questions. Not about that. Let me speak the way I want. I am used, or I was used, and I was coming to, you know, some of the Muslim majority countries to be asked about, what are you going to say? But this is not a democratic, in democratic society we should be able to also understand that if we want to live together, we should be able in the United States of America as well as in Europe to speak about international issues, about what is going on in the Muslim majority countries. You cannot disconnect this from that. If we want to live together, this is the only way with all these challenges to get what is missing today, two things. Trusting each other. I disagree with you, but I'm ready to listen. You are critical, but I'm ready to be challenged. And this is the sense of humility. And the second thing is the sense of belonging. I'm a European, you are Americans, this is your country. Let us, with this new we, come to a critical discussion. We disagree, but our future is common. Or we may disagree, but our future is common. And this is where we should come together. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Ramadan. I'm going to turn now to Dalia Mogahed, and I want to begin by asking you a question as an expert on Muslim public opinion, and perhaps Professor Ramadan will want to respond to this as well. And the question is, why are American Muslims so much less disaffected than European Muslims in general?
Okay. Thank you very much, and thanks you all for being here this evening. I'm going to draw on the research that we've done at Gallup on European Muslims in Britain, France, and Germany, as well as American Muslims. And what we find is that there are several differences between American and European Muslims, but there are also many things that they share. So I'll start with the differences, which is sort of the questions you alluded to. Muslim Americans are, on average, more educated and more affluent than the general public. Muslim American women, for example, are among the most educated women in America. In fact, just second to Jewish women in their level of education. They have no gender gap between Muslim American men and women. Muslim Americans are employed, they're entrepreneurial, they're highly educated. And this is in stark contrast to many Muslim communities who are European, where they are, on average, much less likely to be employed, socioeconomically disadvantaged. So that is one big difference. And there are many reasons for this difference. One is the reason that immigrants came to each continent. So many Muslim American immigrants immigrated to this country for education, for higher education, my parents being an example. Just as a huge generalization, but many of European Muslim immigrants came to their countries as laborers. So we're dipping into a different set of communities within each country. The other distinction or unique aspect of Muslim American communities is that the largest group within our community are African Americans. So they're not immigrants. 35% of the Muslim American community is African American, and they do make up the largest single racial group. So those are some of the differences in terms of socioeconomically. But there are also many similarities, and I think one that might surprise people is that Muslim Americans are not less religious than European Muslims. And I think that there's a misconception that there's sort of an implicit connection between success economically and educationally and somehow being more secular. And that's not the case at all, in fact. Muslim Americans are, in fact, slightly more religious, a larger percentage of Muslim Americans say religion is an important part of their daily life than do European Muslims. But on the question of identity, because I think that's a really important question, Professor Ramadan touched on it, we ask a question around identity, and we ask people to tell us how strong they identify with their faith, and then we ask them how strong they identify with their country, how strong they identify with their ethnicity, and we ask each identity separately so that you're not choosing between identities, but you're simply scaling each one. And what we found is that Muslims in Europe, as well as Muslims in the United States, are as likely as the general public to identify strongly with their nation. Specifically in Britain, Muslim British citizens are more likely than the general public to say they identify strongly with their nation. Where they are very different from the general public, especially in Europe, is on their identity with their faith. Muslims identify much stronger with their faith than does the general public with theirs. And so there is this confusion that these two identities are competing, when in fact, when you look at how they relate to one another, they are not inversely proportional, meaning having a stronger religious identity does not correlate with a weaker national identity. They are actually, they have no relationship in that way. They are complementary identities. Some of the other things we found specific to citizenship is that European Muslims, like American Muslims, have a great deal of confidence in their national institutions. So institutions like the judicial system, the honesty of elections, the national government, at least as likely, and in many cases much more likely, as are many immigrants, more likely than the general public to express confidence in these democratic institutions. But where there are similar challenges, even though Muslim Americans tend to be more educated, more affluent, etc., largely successful socioeconomically, they do share one basic challenge with European Muslims, and that is that significant minorities in both societies, significant minorities of the general public doubt Muslim citizen loyalty. So around 44% will say that they don't believe Muslims living in their country are loyal to the country. So there is this issue of a doubt, an ongoing issue with Muslim Europeans or Western Muslims in general having to prove their loyalty or being seen as having dual loyalties, which is not borne out in the research. And finally, I'll just end with our research on sympathy for violence, because I think that underlying all of these discussions, whenever we're talking about secularism, democracy, integration, underlying all of these discussions is always this security concern. And I think it's important to understand the research. We found that, first of all, Muslims in general are no more likely, in many cases less likely, than the American public and European publics to express sympathy with violence targeted at civilians. So that's just one basic fact. The other thing we found is that among the minority who do express sympathy for violence against civilians, terrorism, that minority group is no more likely than the general public or no more likely than the mainstream Muslim community to be religious. And in fact, when they are asked to justify their position on violence, they do not use religious justifications. They use political, socio, or geopolitical justifications for that position. And I can answer many questions about why do terrorists use religious rhetoric in their recruiting. But what we do find in our research is among the general public, those aren't the justifications used for the sympathy for these acts of violence.
Thank you. Well, I'll turn to Joan Scott then. Joan, Orthodox Islam has to be one of the most powerful forces for the oppression of women in the world today. They are. You can dispute this, but they are.
Not Catholicism.
Well, it's directional. All right, but there are women are in many places forced or pressured to wear burqas, veils. They can't drive in Saudi Arabia. They can't be in the clergy. The list goes on and on. My question to you is whether you're satisfied with Professor Ramadan's views on the role of women in Islamic society.
Okay, well, we haven't heard them all exposed tonight, but I think for a feminist, and I certainly consider myself a feminist, the question of gender equality is not a straightforward and obvious one in these discussions. In fact, I would say that gender equality has been used as a kind of veil for the social and economic inequalities that Muslims experience, certainly in Western European societies. So that, for example, in a country like France, there's a great deal of discussion of gender inequality and much less discussion of social and economic equality, which has led, for example, to unemployment rates among Muslims being at the same level of education and age and so on, being 2.5 times as great as unemployment levels among French nationals without any change for the last 15 years, a steady, constant inequality, sense of discrimination. If you go to the discussions that were had during the riots in 2005, the number of kids who would say, I have all the qualifications for this particular job, I sent in an application with my name on it, and that was the end of the possibility for the job. There have actually been groups that have done tests of discrimination in which they send in exactly the same CV, one with a Muslim name on it and one with a French name on it, and the French gets the job and the Muslim doesn't get the job. So there is a huge, in these countries of Western Europe, I think the distinction, the class distinctions between American Muslims and European Muslims are really important to take into account. In a country like France as well, the history of colonialism marks Muslims as an inferior colonized peoples who are to be civilized. The French notion was that there was a civilizing mission that they were carrying on as the part of their imperial adventure. And that stays attached in some ways to North African, West African, and Muslim populations. So I think the issue of gender equality has been used as a distraction in many cases. The question of the status of women in Islam has been used as a distraction, so it's not as necessary to talk about these social and economic issues. It also diverts attention from the continuing social and economic, the continuing gender inequalities within the Western countries, so that in France, although there's a law that requires equal numbers of women on all ballots in elections, 16% of the parliament are women. In the United States, 18% of the Congress are women. And we could go into salary differentials and all the rest of it. That all gets put aside or neglected in the contrast between the equality that we supposedly experience and the equality that they don't have. In fact, I've been fascinated by the way in which Western politicians, men for the most part, who have spent most of their careers trying to interfere with the reproductive rights of women, with access of women to politics, with the rights of women in job markets and other kinds. These guys have suddenly become champions of Muslim women's equality, an equality defined as, very vaguely defined, as equality. But if you ask what exactly is meant by equality, well, it's not wearing a headscarf. It's not wearing a burqa. In fact, many of the women who wear burqas or headscarves, but certainly the headscarves are the ones I know something about, will tell you that they've chosen to do it not because their parents are forcing them to do it, not because their brothers are threatening their lives, but because they represent a younger generation of Europeans who want to insist on the integrity of their religious beliefs as well as on their the fact of their citizenship in many of these countries. So the notion of a kind of forced, the notion that there's one meaning for the veil and that it is the oppression of women is again something that is not borne out by the facts and the testimony of many of these women.
Just to get this straight, the answer to the question is, are you concerned about the oppression of Muslim women and the way Professor Ramadan deals with that problem? And the answer is women in the West are oppressed too. And I take your point, and yes, they are. But
no,
there are very specific roles that are denied to women in Islamic societies, professional roles, the clergy. There is explicit discrimination, and I don't hear you very
concerned
about it.
I'd like to have your information on that. The Iranian parliament has more women in it than the American legislature.
How about the Iranian clergy?
No, but how about the rabbinate in the United States, the Orthodox? I'm not saying that these are the same. What I'm saying is that the issue of gender equality is a way of distracting the conversation from some of the things that need to be talked about, which are discrimination against women, discrimination against women in the West, and discrimination against Muslims in many of these Western countries. Okay, but I still have a question. I do have a question that I'm going to get to, because in my own sort of secular feminist thinking about these things, obviously questions come up that are disturbing, but it seems to me the questions have to be asked within the context of a nuanced appreciation of the way in which the issue of gender equality is being instrumentalized for political reasons that have very little to do, in the end, with feminists' goals on either side of the question. So the famous issue that Professor Ramadan is always accused by President Sarkozy of France and many other people as well of ducking on is the question of the stoning of adulterous women. I actually think that his solution to the problem is not a bad one. That is that there be a moratorium. He has said, he can say it himself, but he has said that he opposes...
This is a tough question.
Yes, yeah. That he opposes stoning, but that he thinks there ought to be a moratorium on it so that Muslim jurists can deliberate it, because unless the discussion happens from within, unless there is a set of interpretive arguments, that the issue will not be resolved, and it certainly can't be a Western imposition on the religious teachings or the religious interpretations of a particular group. So I think I would accept that, but still I would ask the question, okay? And the question, the gender question is, And it comes not so much from a Western feminist's perspective as it does from what I know of Islamic feminists. And my question is, exactly what role would women have in these conversations about the ending of stoning? How would their voices be represented? What sort of role would they play in the interpretive debates that need to be had around a question as difficult as that? And I have many other things to say, but I'll stop there.
Yes. Let me just go straight to your question, because there are many other things that I wanted to comment. But on this question, and this is, you know, once again, I was having an interview this afternoon, and once again, the same story came. And this happened, in fact, in 2003. And for the last now 10, 12 years, I have been advocating the fact that what we need in the Muslim majority countries is really a moratorium. So what did I mean, and what do I mean now, and in which way we have to involve women in the whole process? Once again, you cannot sit here by condemning. And first, you know, stoning in Islam, you know, in the mainstream and the classical, it has nothing to do with women. It has to do with men and women. So it's not something which is only about women being involved, it's men and women. My position is not only on this. It's on hudud, it's the penal code. It's on death penalty, stoning, and corporal punishment. Saying we have to stop now and to open a debate within the Muslim majority country with the scholars. Why? Because you are dealing with people who believe that there are texts coming from God. So by condemning, you are not going to change anything. And many are condemning. If you were talking about Sarkozy, now he's telling us that Saudi Arabia is a moderate country. That's fine. Who had a double talk? The point for me is really to be consistent. If we want things to evolve, it's exactly this. It's from within. So to ask three questions, what do the texts say? What are the conditions? In which context we can implement this? And let this to be open. But don't accept things that are happening now that are implemented against poor people and women, not against, you know, the rich people, and we are all silent. What is in the petrol monarchies today is known by everyone, but we are silent. Why? Because they have the money. They have the money. We are hypocritical on that. So the position for me is to make things moving. What I want is men and women to be involved in the discussion, but not only on this. Mm-hmm. In everything which has to do with, you know, religious discussion on contemporary issues. So, for example, in the last book on these issues on the fundamentals of Islamic law and jurisprudence, the book Radical Reform, I'm advocating specialists in every specific field, men and women, to be involved. Of course, in the gender equality we need, but not only this. I don't want the women to speak about only about women issues. And it may be that for me, you know, I said it and I repeat this, one of the most important problems women have within the Islamic tradition is men.
It's not a joke.
It's really something which is critical. This is where we have to talk about involving people in a critical discussion on this, because there are projection, cultural projection, reduction of the text to something which is a literal reading. So I would say what the way you were portraying the Muslim majority countries, I would say that, yes, we have many problems. But we have to go beyond only, you know, repeating some of the stories to come to see what is happening in Muslim majority countries as well. And I can tell you that in many Muslim majority countries, even in Saudi Arabia today, you have trends of women being more educated, more involved, and challenging this patriarchal, macho authority, which is a reductive take on the scriptural sources, on the Quran. You also have to listen to them. They may say, we don't want westernization, but we want freedom. And it may be that we can get freedom without westernization. And we should be humble enough in the West, you and me, to accept that they could be free, but not like us.
I'll turn now to George Packer to continue this conversation. George, there are two persistent criticisms of Professor Ramadan which you encounter if you start to read about him. One is, and I'm merely summarizing here. I'm not taking this position myself. So I'm serious. But one is that he engages in a kind of doublespeak, that he says very different things in front of an audience like this in the West as opposed to what he would say in front of an Islamic audience in France or in a Muslim country. And the other one is that in his desire to accommodate everyone, both liberals and Orthodox Muslims, he sort of evades hard questions and conflicts and fundamental tensions between an open society and religious fundamentalism. And I wonder if you, as someone who has looked at this, thinks either of those criticisms is justified. And perhaps you can ask him some questions yourself that'll help us all form an opinion about that.
Okay. Well, first, I want to welcome you to the U.S. It took 6 years too long. I wrote at the time that it was a disgrace for you to be banned from this country. It made the United States look illiberal and afraid and closed, and I feel that today our country can say we are not as afraid as we might have seemed. So I'm glad you're here. I don't buy the argument that Professor Ramadan is two-faced or speaks out of both sides of his mouth or says one thing to one audience and another to another. I just don't see any evidence of it. And there is evidence that he says the same thing to every audience. There's a very good profile written by my wife about Professor Ramadan, which I've read a few times. Apparently, she's the only journalist who ever accompanied him on his speaking appearances in mosques and community centers in France. And she found that he was telling them anti-Semitism is a terrible thing and it is to be avoided and there should be no, et cetera, et cetera. So her findings and everything I've read of his tells me that it's an open book. There's not a hidden agenda. In fact, there are many open books. He's prolific. The second question, I don't know the answer to yet, and I'm going to use tonight to try to get an answer. You said part of being here is to be challenged. So I want to ask you two questions that are challenging questions, and partly in order to answer, or to try to begin to answer Jacob's second question. One of them is a historical question, and the other is a philosophical question. And they may seem like they're about far away or ancient things, but I think they're relevant. And they're really about the foundation on which you're building a bridge. You are a bridge builder, and I think it is a good thing that you're doing that, and I think your bridge is going to lead to a better place than any of the alternatives that I can think of. But I worry about the foundation on which you're building the bridge. And to get to the historical question, which is about that foundation, a book is about to be published by the writer Paul Berman called The Flight of the Intellectuals. And there's a chapter in that book that's about the relationship between Hassan al-Banna, your grandfather and the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Hajj Amin al-Husseini. And the book describes Hassan al-Banna's tireless support for the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem in the 30s and 40s, and the convergence of their views on certain questions. For those in the audience who don't know, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem was a leading collaborator with Nazi Germany. So willing a collaborator that he did a series of radio broadcasts from Berlin during the war in which he incited Arabs to rise up and kill the Jews. It was genocidal radio broadcasting along the lines of Hutu power in Rwanda in 1994. And it was only because of the accident of Rommel's defeat at Al-Alamein that there was no chance for that to happen. Your grandfather, Hassan al-Banna, waged a tireless campaign of solidarity with the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, managed to help him escape any war crimes trial that might have followed the war, and brought him back to Cairo after the war, and said upon the Grand Mufti's arrival, this hero who challenged an empire and fought Zionism with the help of Hitler in Germany. Germany and Hitler are gone, but Amin al-Husseini will continue the struggle. He said even more direct things, or wrote them. He wrote in his epistle to the young that Mussolini's Italy and the German Reich were models for the Muslim Brotherhood. And he wrote in his To What Do We Summon Mankind that Hitler and King Saud were also models for the Brotherhood. You've written about his life in your book, Aux Sources du Renouveau Musulman, which I've read. But you haven't written about these things. You have not gone into the detail that Paul Berman exhaustively goes into in his book. And it makes me ask, is there a limit to what you're willing to say or even to think? Is there a red line, which is your lineage, your heritage? I'm not attributing these views to you, and I'm not asking you to repudiate your grandfather. I'm asking you why you haven't condemned him for his association with the Grand Mufti and for these statements, which actually, they're not just ancient history, because one of your grandfather's followers, Yusuf al-Qaradawi, who preaches on Al Jazeera from Qatar, he's Egyptian-born, just last year said Hitler was sent by Allah as a punishment for the corruption of the Jews. I don't know if you condemned it at the time. You've spoken quite highly of Sheikh al-Qaradawi. So my first question is, do you condemn these things? Or is there a limit to the breadth of your ethical vision? Let me ask the second question, and then we'll get to that. The second question is philosophical. Where do rights come from? That's my basic question. Do they come, are they inherent in being human, or do they come from revealed religion? Do they come from the texts, which are subject to interpretation by, as Jacob pointed out, usually male religious authorities? And it's an important question. It's foundational. It gets at your vision of what we are as human beings and as citizens. It's especially important in Muslim-majority countries, because in those countries, especially where there is essentially an Islamic state, those rights, which may exist today, can be taken away tomorrow if the body of the clerics decides on a new interpretation. So we may have an enlightened Tariq Ramadan-like interpretation today, but tomorrow we might find that that's changed. And that's the nature of rights that are not inherent and universal, but that are based in religion and in religious text. And the fact that, in my experience in Muslim countries, there is a serious abridgment of thought and expression, especially about religion, is a consequence of rights not being inherent, but coming from an authority. That's the basic difference. But I think it also has an effect in Europe, where Muslims are a minority, because in the case of the Danish cartoons, the question I had was, do they have a right to insult other people's religions? I don't like insulting people's religions. It's bad manners. But I think people have an absolute right to do it. And I think the organizations that help bring you here are based on defending that right. And yet, I think among a good many Muslims in Europe, and not just the ones who advocate or even seek to carry out violence against those cartoonists, who are a serious few, there isn't that absolute conviction that there's a right, that the freedom of expression includes the right to insult, ridicule other people's religion. So I guess I ask, where do rights come from, and do they include that right?
Okay.
You can take a few minutes.
I have more than 2 minutes.
Yeah, that's okay.
So about your first question, let me tell you something about, you know, you spoke about the book of Paul Berman, which is going to be published. And I've been asked, you know, I arrived yesterday for the last, this morning, at least three times about this book.
and I read what he was writing before. I can just tell you something which is quite important for me. Mainly, I was expecting something else from someone from his reputation, because he's translating things that I have been facing during the last 20 years in Europe, about my grandfather, about the moratorium and all this. This is a book of translation from French to English of some of the points, and I responded to many of this. But on the specific point that you are referring to, and on my grandfather, once again, I said it. I'm coming from this family, and I'm studying and I studied his life and what he has been doing. And I put this into the context of the 30s and the 40s in Egypt. Many things that he was saying, for example, resisting the British colonization, educating the people, spreading, you know, the message of Islam as something which was a resisting force, this is something that I respect. Now there are other things, and the organization, the hierarchy, these are things that I have been critical, and I said it. Now on this very specific point, if you can find me a true quotation, because this is what is in the book I wrote, that what Hassan al-Banna said about the Nazi and the fascist is, this is the distortion of the European nationalism. And I quote this sentence in the book. His support to the Mufti is something which is supporting the Mufti against what was happening in Palestine, which is the silent colonization, and especially the Stern and Irgun groups, which were terrorist groups. This is from against them that he was speaking that way. So we should also contextualize this. Now, anything which has to do from anyone, from my grandfather or anyone, supporting the Nazi or supporting the killing of Jews, because there are Jews on anti-Semitism, I'm condemning it. So there is no limit from whoever is saying this. But I don't want wrong quotation and things that are not put in this very specific context, saying, I am supporting the Mufti in the name of Islam against anything which has to do with colonization and the creation of, he was against the creation of Israel. This is quite clear. In that time, in this specific context, we also have to listen to some of what he was saying, some of the quotation that he was.
Well, one of the quotes I read was from a book called Nazi Propaganda in the Arab World, which was published last year by Jeffrey Herf, which uses files from the American Embassy in Cairo, which were transcribing both the Mufti's radio broadcast from Berlin and Al-Banna's speech in Cairo when the Mufti came to Cairo after the war. So these are from scholarly works.
But the point is, there is no discussion about the fact that he supported him as a force against, you know, the creation of Israel. There is no discussion about this.
But don't you think, to support him for that reason, after he's just spent 5 years giving aid and comfort and genocidal radio broadcasts from Berlin, taints the Muslim Brotherhood, to say the least, beginning?
No, the point is that the support in this specific period of time that we had even in Europe by people supporting, because they were, even in France we have this, to condemn this support and to say any kind of support towards the Nazi was wrong, I have no difficulty of saying this was wrong and not acceptable. But now what I'm telling you is that quotation coming from Hassan al-Banna, supporting the Nazi or supporting anti-Semitism, the way you describe this, I'm challenging this because I didn't find this quotation the way they were put. Now, if this is the case and you can come with the true quotation, not what, you know, many things were said about Hassan al-Banna that he, if you come back to the text, you find exactly other quotation and things that are not exactly the opposite. I came with the quotation when he's saying the fascist system is a distortion of nationalism and this is not the way we should go. So on this point, to be clear, that right. I'm basing my position here on quotation, and if this is the case, if you can find it, I will condemn this. Now, the support of the Mufti in this specific situation, we have to contextualize, but the support of anything which has to do with supporting the Nazi system is something that I won't accept and I won't defend.
I guess one of Berman's points is that in your Osur Stu Renouveau Musulman, you mention Albana's relationship with the Mufti, but you say nothing about the Mufti's years in Nazi Germany during the war, and it seems as if you're whitewashing that very important part of the Mufti's thought and action in order to let your grandfather off the hook, as it were?
No, I don't think that this is right. I'm talking about the position of my grandfather towards Israel. And there are three things that I'm not hiding. He was against the creation of Israel at that time, and this was the position of all the Arabs. This is one. Second, he was using all the allies that he can get, but he never supported the fascist systems. Never. This is what I'm saying, and this is true, and this is based on what he wrote, because there are 2,000 articles that were not published that we have. He never supported the Nazi or the fascist system. This is not true. This is the second thing that I'm saying. And the third thing that I'm saying is that this also has to be contextualized. So it's not a book on the relationship with the Mufti and what the Mufti was doing. Now, if for you this shows that he's supporting the Nazi system, I think it's not enough. He was supporting the resistance towards what was the project of the creation of Israel.
I don't like contextualizing a long-term alliance with a leading Nazi propagandist and collaborator. To me, there's nothing to contextualize.
No. No, I think that this is not the way it should be put. Because he was not, and once again, he was the Mufti of Egypt, the Mufti of Jerusalem. He decided his own strategy. Hassan al-Banna was not responsible of his strategy. He supported someone saying that Palestine should be freed from anything which was an attempt to create the state of Israel on that place. This is what was his position. Now you cannot, and if you should do this, you should do this even with the United States of America, that sometimes you have allies in very specific situation that you are not supporting all their views. It happened in the European history, even with the resistance. So I would say that on that point, my text was not about the relationship and what the Mufti was saying, is that the very specific position, and the very specific position is that you cannot find in anything which was coming from Hassan al-Banna a support for the Nazi.
But it's an elision. It's an elision that worries me, because it suggests that to go down a road that would actually be difficult for you, you pulled back, you retreated from that road because it would have raised hard questions about your grandfather and the Brotherhood.
No, I think we've aired this issue very well. Let me just interject for 1 minute to say we want to give time for the audience to ask questions as well. Now is a good moment to take a brief pause. If you have questions written down, there will be some people circulating to collect them, pass them to the end of the aisle, and then towards the front. And we'll keep the conversation while everyone does that. Quietly, I hope.
Can I just ask George a question?
What's that?
Can I just ask George a question?
Sure.
George, your second question, which we didn't get to.
I hope we will, yeah.
Yeah, we'll come
back
to
that. But when you say, where do rights come from, and you juxtapose revealed religious texts which have to be interpreted, or rights inherent in humans, what do you mean? I mean, it seems to me the notion of rights, historically, that notion of inherent rights comes from the Enlightenment. You're treating it in some ways as a revealed truth as well, when in fact it's a historically produced, it's humanly produced, historically produced, and equally open to interpretation. I mean, the Supreme Court, just to take one example, takes the Constitution, which lists what our rights supposedly are, and reinterprets it all the time.
Well,
so I think
I will answer that, but I'd first like to hear Professor Ramadan's answer to the philosophical question.
Maybe I can frame the question in a slightly different way while we're collecting the questions. Professor Ramadan, I should say, welcome to America as well. And I'm sorry I neglected to say that at the beginning. I think all of us in this room, I'm sure, support the idea of a bridge between liberalism and Orthodox Islam. And the question, my question, is that kind of bridge possible, and how serious are you about providing it? And I think George's second question goes to that point. And I guess I would frame it a little differently in terms of religious tradition and liberalism. In all of the world's traditions, religious traditions, there are parts that don't reflect contemporary social practice. You can read Deuteronomy. It's true in Judaism and Christianity, in probably every faith. But in almost every faith, there have been voices through history who have tried to accommodate the religion to contemporary social practice. And in fact, the way that religious thinkers have often done this has been by reinterpreting religious texts and saying that, in fact, correctly interpreted, that text does not require the stoning of women or permit polygamy or demand religious courts or so on and so on. And I guess my philosophical question for you is, where are you on the continuum between, on the one hand, the way you're sometimes described as a Muslim Martin Luther, who is an active participant in that reinterpretation, and on the other hand, the Muslim Jerry Falwell, who takes a literal position on text and says, yes, we have to accommodate our societies, but the law is the law, and the Quran says what it says?
Yes, I have been working on that, and I think that between your two questions, and I've been working on that by saying, look, first, there is something which is quite important, is that for the Muslims and the mainstream, what you call Orthodox, is that it is the very word of God. But the point is that this is where the discussion starts, that it was revealed over 23 years, and it should be, and it is, open to interpretations. And what I'm saying is not new. It's something which is as old as the Islamic legal tradition. By saying it has to be contextualized. Of course, we have fundamentals. They're not going to change the way we pray, the way what we call the ibadat, everything which has to do with worship, and the fundamentals. But now, from the very beginning, in the legal Islamic tradition, there is something which is a critical reading of the scriptural sources and not denying the fact that you can add to what you get from the text anything which is coming from the common rationality. This is not something which is new in the Islamic tradition. Quite the opposite. If you listen to Alain de Libera, the French philosopher who is a specialist of the Middle Age, he is saying that this separation of authority between something which is coming from revelation and something coming from rationality, in fact, the Christianity got this from the Islamic legal tradition plus the Jewish legal tradition. This is not something which is alien to the Islamic tradition, that we are having both. So there is no way for me to tell you what is produced by common human rationality is against the text, or saying that what is coming from the text is not subject to interpretation. So it's an ongoing process between this and that. Does it mean that there are principles that are beyond, you know, history? Yes. What I said, the fundamentals for a believer is, you know, what we have when it comes to the creeds, when it comes to the practice. But when it comes to implementing, what I'm saying, for example, in the discussion that we had on the moratorium, some of the texts are clear-cut. For some of the scholars, there is no discussion. This has to be implemented. The point is that we need to understand that there are conditions and the context. So in the light of the context, I'm coming with a reinterpretation of the text by saying, if you implement the text literally, you are going to betray the very end, the objective of the text. All this is coming from what? It's coming from rationality, a critical reading. And this is, once again, something which is part of the Islamic tradition. So when you are telling me that there are things that are, you know, universality, it's coming from our common rationality, I would say yes. But it doesn't mean that because it's coming also for me from revelation, it's going to contradict something which is coming from our common rationality. I would say the opposite. In my next book, which is called The Quest for Meaning, Developing a Philosophy of Pluralism, I'm talking about faith and reason by saying that these are not contradictory dimensions when it comes to this. So I would say that when it comes to the legal tradition, we have to, the question will be about the limits. What and how are we going to deal with the limits? What I can tell you today is that, for example, be quite fair, and once again, it's exactly the same attitude with the first question. It's really to be quite precise in what we are talking about. You know,
I think I was pretty precise in the first question.
No, no,
But the first question, yes, but my answer is quite precise. When I'm telling you why I'm writing what I'm writing about and in which way I'm distancing myself from anything which has to do with supporting, you know, Nazi and fascists, this is unacceptable, and this is my position, and it would be the case. But the point is that look at what happened with the cartoon and what happened also with the Geert Wilders movie on, you know,
Submission.
No, the other one, which is on fitna, what he was doing afterward. If you listen and you look at what is happening with Muslims and Western and European Muslims, what they were, the first reaction in the cartoon by Danish Muslims was not what, you know, say, we don't understand. They didn't react for 3 months. And what you should understand that something happened in Denmark, which was a political game. The ambassadors asked the prime minister to welcome them and to talk. He refused. And then they came back to the countries of origin, and they played with this, and it became a political issue. It has nothing to do with Danish Muslim citizens saying, no, you can't do this. It was not the case. Now we have demonstrations and people in Muslim-majority countries refusing this. But look at what happened with Geert Wilders in the Netherlands. He did this, and they say, we abide by the law, and they took a critical distance from that. And this is my position. It's legal to do it. I think it's silly. It's legally silly, but do it. And take a critical distance on that. And I would say that even non-Muslim in our Western society may think that, yes, it's legal, and we have to say, I don't want new law. I don't want to add in the name of something which is coming from God. I say, let us come to our common
but
rule
if,
of law.
If you...
Yeah. I'm sorry, George.
Okay.
I don't want to interrupt this very good conversation. On the other hand, we only have a little more than 10 minutes left, and there are a lot of questions, and I want to try to get through quite a few of them if we can. And I have one more question for you, which I'm asking you only because I've seen it 4 times on the card, so it is the most common question here. It's about Islam and homosexuality. In an article on your website, you wrote, all the world's major religions and spiritual traditions, from the majority view in Hinduism, Buddhism, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, condemn and forbid homosexuality. Muslims are now being called upon to condemn the Quran and to accept and promote homosexuality to gain entry into the modern world. You also call homosexuality behavior considered reprehensible under the rules of morality. Is sex between two people of the same gender wrong under your moral code, and can one be gay and a good Muslim?
I responded to that many times, but the quotation, the second one, is not what I'm saying. I say, according to Islam, this is the way homosexuality is perceived. So it's quite clear. From all the monotheistic tradition to Buddhist to the Dalai Lama, are not, you know, the spiritualities are not promoting homosexuality. This is to be said because this is the mainstream and these are the teachings coming from the religions. What I'm advocating then and saying something which is quite clear, Islam is not promoting homosexuality. What should be the attitude of the Muslims? Is to be able to say, I disagree with what you are doing, but I respect who you are. And this is what, in a pluralistic society, should be the common ground. You may disagree with the fact that, you know, I'm a practicing Muslim, but I'm asking you to respect who I am. And for the Muslims, is to be able, in our society, to be able to say this, I respect who you are, I respect your rights, but I may disagree with what you are doing. This is one thing. The second thing is, and I said it once, and it was published in Prospect Magazine. I said to the Muslims, if someone is a homosexual, man or woman, and he's saying, I'm a Muslim, it's not for me to put someone within or outside Islam. And it's not because you are doing things that for Muslims they are not right that you can say that you are no longer a Muslim. And a behavior is not putting you outside and or within Islam. So you can be a Muslim and you decide the behavior you want to have. This is your responsibility. So I would never say to someone, you are no longer a Muslim because you are homosexual. Now, your decision is yours. Your freedom is your freedom. I respect who you are, and you decide the way you want to behave.
Mm-hmm. All right. As much as we... As much as we in the West are appalled by the treatment of Muslim women, Muslims are equally offended by our depiction of women in music videos and such. How do we get past these differences?
Look, let us be serious about this. It's a very important discussion, because if you go to Muslim majority countries and even with within Muslim communities, the perception is that there is a lack of morality in the West and there is an alienation of women in all this, you know, fashion and music and all that. We have this. You cannot deny that this is there. On the other side, you go to you speak with your fellow Western citizens, and they have the perception that within the Muslim community, it's all about alienation, submission, and oppression. Let us come to a critical discussion. While we are talking about what you were saying, when we speak about freedom, when we speak about autonomy, when, for example, in France, I'm saying about the headscarf, for example, look, the only right position for me is not for you to tell the woman the way they have to dress or not to dress. The only right feminist attitude is to say, you dress the way you want. But to do this, it's really about education and it's about autonomy. It's about autonomy. Let the woman be autonomous. Let them also, when they have the same job and the same skill, have the same salary. This is what I call true feminism, to speak about something which is deep, not the superficiality of our discussion. And then also to be able to say, I could be shocked by the way we are exposing, you know, bodies and to sell music and cars the way we are doing. But I don't want to sit and to say, oh, this is because it's a decadent society. I want to do this as a human being, as someone who is trying to find a new way to dignify men and women. So I would say it's something which is a critical discussion, and we are not getting this discussion. We are not talking about the deep dimension of what it means to be a woman today. For example, my main problem in the Muslim majority countries is not about, you know, rights and duties of women. It's really about being able to speak about women as a human being, as a spiritual being, as a woman who can be emancipated from her ego and being able to experience the spiritual journey. This is the main discussion for me. I don't want to waste my time into something which is, tell me the way you appear and I will know if you are free. I think this is silly.
Let's hold applause, please, because I want to try to get through at least a couple more of these very good questions here. A similarly controversial non-Muslim scholar would not be allowed the same forum in most predominantly Muslim countries. Discuss this irony.
What I'm saying to many Muslims is that what we have as to the reality of our life in Western countries is allowing us much more than what we have in Muslim majority countries. When it comes to freedom, when it comes to being able to speak and being able to move, to be able to, and more than that, when we speak about the objectives of the fundamentals of the Islamic tradition, it's about protecting dignity, intellect, protecting personal integrity. We are much more protected, and these principles are much more respected in the West today than in many Muslim majority countries. So I would say, you know, I'm still banned from 6 Muslim majority countries today because I cannot speak my mind. And I would say that it's not only for an atheist that it's problematic. It's for every single free mind that it's problematic now in many Muslim majority countries. So instead of being happy to be here in a comparative way, we'll always find people who are worse than us. Let us be consistent. Let us from here, as Europeans or as Westerners, as people who are consistent with their values, ask our governments to be consistent with promoting democracy, which doesn't mean to go in Iraq to impose a model and to kill innocent people, but also to be able to speak to petromonarchies, to speak to people who have money, and to say, you should open up towards democracy in your country because this is the way forward. And I would say, I would support this. I am against our lack of consistency in the West, and I'm against anything which is instrumentalizing religion in Muslim majority countries or instrumentalizing secularism, for example, in some countries in the name of, you know, freedom, and when you what you have, you end up having dictatorships. I would say that I would be critical towards these systems the way I am promoting freedom here.
What is your response to critics of Islam, such as Ayaan Hirsi Ali, I know you debated her in London, who claim that normative Islam is not inherently compatible with Western secular values?
The problem I have with Ayaan Hirsi Ali is it's deeper than that. It's not about the criticisms, because many of the things that she's asking or questioning about Islam, I think that we have to listen. There are legitimate questions, and it's good. The point is that what she's saying is that Islam per se is problematic. And Muslims, because they are Muslims, they are problematic. You cannot be a practicing Muslim and being open to democracy, because it's a contradiction in terms. So you want to start discussing, but the discussion is over. Because, okay, I'm a Muslim, so what? So it's over. So you can't. And then she's spreading around mistrust about anything. If you come and say, I'm a practicing Muslim, I abide by the law, I'm a Democrat, I want freedom, I want autonomy. Oh, no. Why? Because you are Muslim. And by definition, Islam. So it's something which is a position which is very close to what I got from populist parties and racists. Targeting you because you are Muslim, it means that the only way to be an open Muslim is to be an ex-Muslim. It's a problem.
I have one more announcement, which is that there are books for sale in the lobby, and if you want to get your book signed, Professor Ramadan has written a lot of books. We've all written books. He's written more than all of us combined. But if you want to get them signed, you can buy your book outside and bring it up here. I'm afraid we're out of time. I know we had a lot more questions, but I really want to thank our panelists and Professor Ramadan for participating tonight.
Yeah. I couldn't help you.